Gentlemen, we do not stop till nightfall.
What about breakfast?
We've already had it.
We've had one, yes. What about second breakfast?
I don't think he knows about second breakfast, Pip.
What about elevensies? Luncheon, afternoon tea, dinner, supper. He knows about them, doesn't he?
Evening, guys. Welcome back to Second Breakfast, episode 6 today. We're going to be discussing the Old Forest and the Withywindle. But before we get into the episode, I'm going to finish lighting the fire. So there we go. Let's shuffle those around. It's already crackling away there. So that should be good. Brilliant. Well, how is everyone? What a crazy world we now live in. 2020 has a lot to answer for, methinks. However, I've always wanted this little show to be a welcome distraction to the outside world at a time when, you know, obviously it's become such a scary and uncertain place. And so with that in mind, I'm not intending to let the real world infiltrate too much into the safety of our hobbit hole, which I hope you'll all understand. The fire is now lit. The moon is outshining brightly in the sky over the Shire outside. And there is a pile of books next to my glass of whiskey here, which I'm excited to delve back into with you all. However, it has been a little while now since I've managed to get an episode of Second Breakfast out to you. We last saw the hobbits encounter old Farmer Maggot about 6 weeks ago now, so I must apologise for that. Work has got quite busy in the last few months, and also family life became a bit of a challenging juggle at times with the three Balrogs, to borrow a description from May. But yesterday, work actually chose to furlough me, which means that I'm now no longer able to do work under the regulations relating to coronavirus. So I am now the proud owner of a lot more free time, meaning I can lose myself in Bag End a little more easily, which I'm intending to do over the coming weeks, fingers crossed. The main show has also been a huge juggle for not just myself, but also James and May. And, you know, they have encountered their own issues with work and family life, with the pressures that are associated with them. We do actually have two recorded shows in the can. And I know James is looking to try to get to those to edit them when his Balrogs allow. Right, so back to Second Breakfast. Most of you by now probably know the premise of the show, but in case you haven't heard any of the previous episodes, I'm going to quickly explain once more. So Second Breakfast started out as a smaller, more personal sideshow to our main show, the Green Door Podcast. And it's just myself, yours truly, trying to not sound too monotone or boring, trying to keep the subject an interesting one. And I'm discussing the history of Middle-earth. So specifically, part one of The Lord of the Rings, which is volume 6, entitled The Return of the Shadow. And as is common now at this juncture, I'm going to highlight some of the books that I'm using, especially today. So I've touched on one already, volume 6, The Return of the Shadow. which was written by the late, great Christopher Tolkien. And really enjoying going through this with you, exploring how the wonderful Lord of the Rings was created. So that's the first one. Then we have The Letters of J.R.R. Tolkien, edited by Humphrey Carpenter, with the assistance again of Christopher Tolkien. We have the biography, J.R.R. Tolkien, by Humphrey Carpenter, again. And we have The Lord of the Rings, A Reader's Companion, by Wayne G. Hammond and Christina Scull. Today, we also have J.R.R. Tolkien's The Adventures of Tom Bombadil, which is edited by Christina Scull and Wayne G. Hammond again, and illustrated by the wonderful Pauline Baynes that we've mentioned in previous episodes. So that's a new book because of where we are in the story. And then finally, by no means least, The Amazing Lord of the Rings by J.R.R. Tolkien. And I don't really have to go into any more detail with regards to that. However, as you know, I have been trying to use in these episodes a different Lord of the Rings book for each one as a way of basically exploring the bookshelf, because I do have, as you know, a number of them. So today I have an edition that I think a lot of you will be very familiar with. It'll probably be on some of your bookshelves as well. And it's the 2004 hardback 50th edition anniversary Lord of the Rings, published by HarperCollins Publishers. And it's a deluxe slipcase volume, which inside, I'm just taking it out of the slipcase now, inside is some full colour pages or leaves from the Book of Mazabul, illustrations by the professor that he intended for inclusion in the Bridge of Khazad-dûm chapter. And then there's also previously unpublished family trees and two fantastic full-size fold-out maps. It's that wonderful maroon colour book with the Eye of Sauron cut into the hard slipcase to match with the illustration on the book itself. And I also have The Hobbit and The Silmarillion in the same hardback set. And the aim, eventually, is to complete the set with the other fantastic coloured collections, all in their own wonderful slipcases. So that's the book, that's the Lord of the Rings that I'm using today. So as a flashback, let's have a quick look back to the last episode, where we explored to Maggot's Farm and Buckland, and where we made our way eventually to a little house on the outskirts of Buckland, which would eventually become Crick Hollow on the edge of the Old Forest. The hobbits, Bingo, all but invisible, and Odo and Frodo had encountered Farmer Maggot and his yappy dog, Gip. So as I said, Bingo, invisibly hidden by a certain piece of jewellery throughout that encounter. They had learnt a bit more about the mysterious black riders that were searching, or perhaps sniffing, for them. And they had had a merry meeting with Marmaduke. So a fourth hobbit had arrived on the scene, who was their friend and fellow hobbit, and he'd met them at Bucklebury Ferry and had showed them to their accommodation. And the original third chapter had ended in manuscript form with the professor describing the four hobbits debating what to do next. "Old Maggot is rather a shrewd fellow," said Marmaduke. "A good deal goes on behind his round face, which does not come out in his talk. He used to go into the Old Forest at one time and had the reputation of knowing a thing or two outside the Shire. Anyway, I can guess no better. What are you going to do about it?" "There is nothing to do," said Bingo, "except to go home, which is difficult for me as I haven't got one now. I shall just have to go on as the elves advised. But you need not come, of course." "Of course not," said Marmaduke. "I joined the party just for fun, and I am certainly not going to leave it now. Besides, you will need me. Three's company, but four's more. And if the hints of the elves mean what you think, There are at least four riders, not to mention an invisible sniff and a black bundle on the landing stage. My advice is, let us start off even earlier tomorrow than we planned and see if we can't get a good start. I rather fancy riders will have to go round by the bridges to get across the river. But we shall have to go much the same way, said Bingo. We shall have to strike the East Road near Brandywine Bridge. That's not my idea, said Marmaduke. I think we should avoid the road at present. It's a waste of time. We should actually be going back westward if we made for the road meeting near the bridge. We must make a shortcut northeast through the old forest. I will guide you. How can you? Asked Oddo. Have you ever been there? Oh, yes, said Marmaduke. All the Brandybucks go there occasionally when the fit takes them. I often go, only in daylight, of course, when the woods are fairly quiet and sleepy. Still, I know my way about. If we start early and push along, we ought to be quite safe and clear of the forest before tomorrow night. I have got five good ponies waiting, sturdy little beasts. Not speedy, of course, but good for a long day's work. They're stabled in a shed out in the fields behind this house. I don't like the idea at all, said Oddo. I would rather meet these riders, if we must meet them, on a road where there is a chance of meeting ordinary honest travellers as well. I don't like woods, and I have heard queer tales of the old forest. I think black riders will be very much more at home there than we shall. But we shall probably be out of it again before they get in, said Marmaduke. Seems to me silly, anyway, when you are beginning an adventurous journey to start by going back and jogging along a dull riverside road in full view of all the numerous hobbits of Buckland. Perhaps you would like to call and take leave of old Rory at the hall. It would be polite and proper, and he might lend you a carriage. I knew you would propose something rash, said Oddo, but I am not going to argue any more. If the others agree, let's vote, though I am sure I shall be the odd man out. He was, though Bingo and Frodo took some time to make up their minds. There you are, said Oddo. What did I say this morning? 3-1. Well, I only hope it comes off all right. Now, that's settled, said Marmaduke. We had better get to bed. But first, we must clear up and do all the packing we can. Come on. So the old forest was to be the destination of the story, with, remember, Tom Bombadil, the Willow Man, and the Barrow-wights already established previously in Tolkien's mind. And this chapter fits nicely with Chapter 6 of The Fellowship of the Ring, The Old Forest. And as always, it might be a good thing for you to try and reread some aspects of this chapter before you listen to this episode to appreciate a bit more some of the similarities and differences that we might be discussing. Now, Christopher Tolkien states that in a letter from his father to C.A. Firth of Allen and Unwin, dated the 31st of August 1938 and known in the letters of J.R.R. Tolkien as Letter 33, that in the last two or three days, after the benefit of idleness and open air and the sanctioned neglect of duty, I have begun again on the sequel to The Hobbit, The Lord of the Ring. It is now flowing along and getting quite out of hand. It has reached about Chapter 7 and progresses towards quite unforeseen goals. I must say I think it is a good deal better in places and some ways than the predecessor, but that does not say that I think it either more suitable or more adapted for its audience. For one thing, it is, like my own children, who have the immediate serial rights, rather older. I can only say that Mr. Lewis, my stout backer of the Times and TLS, professes himself more than pleased. If the weather is wet in the next fortnight, we may have got still further on. But it is no bedtime story. And Christopher adds that it is clear that in those few days, the hobbits had passed through the old forest by way of the Withywindle Valley, stayed in the house of Tom Bombadil, escaped from the Barrow-wight, and reached Bree. So without further ado, let's pick up the story with the fourth original chapter written by the professor and see what happened all those years ago at the end of August 1938 in the scribblings of Tolkien's pencil. So the original chapter 4 is entitled The Old Forest and the Withywindle. There is no Fatty Bulger to wish the hobbits goodbye, but there is still a very familiar opening, nonetheless. They got onto the ponies and rode off into the mist. After riding more than an hour, they came to the hedge. It was tall and netted over with silver cobwebs. "How do we get through this?" said Oddo. "There is a way," said Marmaduke. Following him along the hedge, they came to a small brick-lined tunnel. It went down a gully and dived right under the hedge, coming out some 20 yards at the far side, where it was closed by a gate of close iron bars. Marmaduke unlocked this, let them out, and locked it again. As it snapped back, they all felt a sudden pang. "There," said Marmaduke, "you have now left the Shire and are outside and close to the edge of the Old Forest." "Are the stories about it true?" said Oddo. "I don't know what stories you mean. If you mean the old bogey stories our nurses used to tell us about goblins and wolves and things of that sort, no. But it is queer. Everything in the Old Forest is very much more alive, more aware of what is going on than in the Shire. And they don't like strangers. The trees watch you, but they don't do much in daylight. Occasionally, the most malicious ones may drop a branch or stick a root out or grasp at you with long trailers. But at night, things can get most disturbing, I am told. I've only once been in the Old Forest, and then only near the edge after dark. I thought the trees were all whispering to each other, although there was no wind, and the branches waved about and groped. They do say the trees actually move and can surround strangers and hem them in. They used long ago to attack the hedge, come and plant themselves right by it and lean over it. But we burnt the ground all along the east side for miles, and they gave it up. There are also queer things living deep in the forest and on the far side, but I have not heard that they are very fierce, at least not in daytime. But something makes paths and keeps them open. There is the beginning of a great and broad one that goes more or less in our direction. That is the one I am making for." So there's similarities with the Fellowship. We have the hedge and we have the gate. We have the stories and the path, and also the beginnings of what would become the bonfire glade. And the story continues along with the hobbits moving along their way as the trees close in, becoming more and more menacing. And it makes the hobbits feel like they're actually being watched. And even their attempts at singing, which is, you know, a very hobbit-like thing to do, even the singing appears to annoy the trees as branches start to fall on the ground behind them when Marmaduke starts to sing. Christopher Tolkien then describes how his father's narrative concludes with notes of what may follow. So the text, you know, the story starts to become more note-like, and it mentions Willowman, it mentions Tom Bombadil, and then struck out there's also the word Barrow-wights as well. And the sketch of the continuing story continues on another page. The path winds on and they get tired. They cannot get any view. At last they see a bare hillock crowned by a few pines, a head looking down onto the path. They reach this and find the mist gone and the sun very hot and nearly above. 11 o'clock. They rest and eat, but they can see only forest all round and cannot make out either hedge or line of the road northward, but the bare downland east and south lies green-grey in the distance. Beyond the hillock, the path turns southwards. They determine to leave it and strike northeast by the sun, but trees bar the way. They are going downhill, and brambles and bushes, hazels and whatnot block them. every, and then in brackets with a question mark, opening, leads them away to their right. Eventually, when it is already afternoon, they find themselves coming to a willow-bordered river, the Withywindle, which incidentally is the first time that Withywindle is actually mentioned. Marmaduke knows this, flows through the forest from the downs to join the Brandywine at Haysend. There seems some sort of rough path going upstream, but a great sleepiness comes on them. Otto and Bingo cannot go on without a rest. They sit down with their backs to a great willow, while Frodo and Marmaduke attend to the ponies. Willow Man traps Bingo and Otto. Suddenly a singing is heard in the distance, and then in brackets again, Tom Bombadil not named. The willow relaxes its hold. So we witness there the first encounter with Tom Bombadil. It was originally far briefer than what we would get to enjoy in the published version. And we see the introduction, as I said, of the Withywindle, and we have Old Man Willow trapping Bingo and Otto, but rescued without the necessary detail that we would later have by Tom's singing. So in that sort of sketch note, we have where this story was starting out. Then what follows in this sketch suggests that the hobbits then continue on their way, and not at this stage to Tom Bombadil's house. Instead, it suggests that there is an encounter with a Barrow-wight, although there is no narrative of this alternative timeline found by Christopher, and he believed that it was probably never actually written further than this sketched out note. But I'm going to say now what that sketched note goes on to mention. They get through to End of Forest as evening comes on and climb onto the downs. It gets very cold. Mist is followed by a chilly drizzle. They shelter under a big barrow. Barrow-wight takes them inside. They wake to find themselves buried alive. They shout. At last, Marmaduke and Bingo begin a song. An answering song outside. Tom Bombadil opens the stone door and lets them out. They go to his house for the night. Two Barrow-wights come, brackets galloping, after them, but stop every time Tom Bombadil turns and looks at them. So there we have it. In this note form, we have what the professor had mapped out for this original chapter 4. But as we know, it's very different, very much a change in approach with regards to Tom Bombadil's role, and certainly where the Barrow-wights make their appearance. Now, regarding the ending of this fourth chapter, where Tom Bombadil appears, concluding with a golden light that was all about them, Christopher Tolkien remarks that the passage was very close to the final published form, apart from some geographical changes as to what side of the Withywindle the hobbits were on when they crossed a bridge on the approach to Tom's house. And I'm gonna read now what Christopher writes with regards to this, because it's a nice, interesting little extract. It is made just as clear here as in Fellowship that the path which the hobbits followed beside the Withywindle lay on the north side of the river, the side from which they descended out of the forest, and it is therefore strange that the approach to Tom Bombadil's house should be described thus. The grass under their feet was smooth and short, and seemed to be mown and shaven. The forest edge behind them was as clipped and trim as a hedge. The path was edged with white stones, and turning sharp to the left, went over a little bridge. It then wound up onto the top of a round knoll. But the path was already on the left side of the river as it went upstream. Later on, this text was very heavily corrected, and the Fellowship version all but achieved, yet this detail was retained. The path was bordered with white stones, and turning sharp to the left, it led them over a wooden bridge. Later again, the word left was changed to right. implying that Tom Bombadil's house lay on the south side of the Withywindle. In Fellowship, there is no mention of a bridge. My father's map of the Shire probably shows that he changed his mind on this point, for the underlying pencil shows TB with a dark mark beside it on the south side, whereas the ink overlay shows the house to the north of the stream. And what I love about this, and the reason I've added this sort of quite detailed aspect, is it shows the incredible detail that the professor continued to put into this story, even to the point of having a extremely clear map in his mind as to where Tom Bombadil's house was and which side of the river they were on. Everything was planned to the detail, and it just makes me smile to think of what went into just this small aspect of the story. So this actual chapter itself is, as you can see, quite short in you know what we can talk about today. And there will be, in the next chapter, entitled Tom Bombadil, far more about the hobbits meeting with Tom. But I'd like to just mention a few interesting asides before we finish today's episode. Now, Tom Bombadil, his beautiful wife, Goldberry, old man Willow, and those pesky Barrow-wights had actually been around for some time before Lord of the Rings ever started its journey from pencil to publisher. And I'm going to read from another of the letters of J.R.R. Tolkien, specifically letter 144, which the professor had written to Naomi Mitchison, who had been reading page proofs of the first two volumes of the Lord of the Rings. And this letter is dated the 25th of April, 1954, and it has a interesting paragraph with regards to Tom Bombadil. The professor writes, "Tom Bombadil is not an important person to the narrative. I suppose he has some importance as a comment. I mean, I do not really write like that. He is just an invention who first appeared in the Oxford Magazine about 1933, and he represents something that I feel important, although I would not be prepared to analyse the feeling precisely. I would not, however, have left him in if he did not have some kind of function. I might put it this way, the story is cast in terms of a good side and a bad side, beauty against ruthless ugliness, tyranny against kingship, moderated freedom with consent against compulsion that has long lost any object save mere power, and so on. But both sides, in some degree, conservative or destructive, want a measure of control. But if you have, as it were, taken a vow of poverty, renounce control and take your delight in things for themselves without reference to yourself, watching, observing, and to some extent knowing, then the question of the rights and wrongs of power and control might become utterly meaningless to you, and the means of power quite valueless. It is a natural pacifist view, which always arises in the mind when there is a war. But the view of Rivendell seems to be that it is an excellent thing to have represented, but there are in fact things with which it cannot cope, and upon which its existence nonetheless depends. Ultimately, only the victory of the West will allow Bombadil to continue, or even to survive. Nothing would be left for him in the world of Sauron." And I'm not today going to go into, as I say, the detail behind sort of Tom Bombadil, but I read that and just thought that was an interesting paragraph to include today with regards to the mysteriousness, the nature of who Tom Bombadil was, and you know why he was deemed to be important as a pre-existing, you know, character that Tolkien had invented all the way back in 1933, but left in, you know, this great Lord of the Rings book that the professor was writing. So although published in the Oxford Magazine on the 15th of February 1934, the poem All About Tom Bombadil was probably written by the professor much earlier still, around 1931. But even earlier than that, we think Tom Bombadil has existed, you know, before this date as well. In J.R.R. Tolkien's The Adventures of Tom Bombadil, the introduction by Christina Scull and Wayne Hammond mentions the following. Tom Bombadil existed in fiction before The Lord of the Rings was conceived. His name was given first to a Dutch doll, a toy made of jointed wooden pegs owned by one or more of Tolkien's children and dressed exactly as Tom is described in The Lord of the Rings, and as Tolkien did with other toys in his household, such as the little lead dog that inspired Rover Random and the teddy bears that appear in Mr. Bliss. He put Tom Bombadil into stories. Which I think is great. I mean, we've mentioned there, you know, the dog and the teddy bears. You know, you also have, thinking back, Bingo, you know, and his connection with the koala bears, linked again to Tolkien's children. So it's lovely to see these little glimpses into Tolkien's personal life and how they then develop into the story as well. Now, going back to the original poem published in 1934, the origins of many Tom Bombadil or Old Forest related gems appear in this poem. And I thought, what better way to conclude our episode tonight than to read some of the verses from this first appearance of Tom the Bomb. I'm not going to read the full poem, so suggest you do try and search the book out if you want to get the full account. But check out how many similarities you can spot from some of the following verses. Old Tom Bombadil was a merry fellow, bright blue his jacket was, and his boots were yellow. He lived down under hill, and a peacock's feather nodded in his old hat, tossing in the weather. Old Tom Bombadil walked about the meadows, gathering the buttercups, a chasing of the shadows, tickling the bumblebees, a buzzing in the flowers, sitting by the waterside for hours upon hours. There his beard dangled long down into the water. Up came Golbry, the river woman's daughter. Pulled Tom's hanging hair, in he went a-wallowing, under the water lilies bubbling and a-swallowing. "Hey, Tom Bombadil, whither are you going?" said fair Golbry. "Bubbles you are blowing, frightening the finny fish and the brown water rat, startling the dab chicks, drowning your feather hat." Up woke Willow Man, began upon his singing, sang Tom fast asleep, under branches swinging. In a crack, caught him tight, quiet it closed together, trapped Tom Bombadil, coat and hat and feather. "Ha, Tom Bombadil, what be you a-thinking, peeping inside my tree, watching me a-drinking, deep in my wooden house, tickling me with feather, dripping wet down my face like a rainy weather." "You let me out again, old man Willow. I am stiff lying here, they're no sort of pillow. Your hard crooked roots drink your river water. Go back to sleep again like the river daughter." Willow man let him loose when he heard him speaking, locked fast his wooden house, muttering and creaking, whispering inside the tree. Tom, he sat a-listening on the boughs. Piping birds were chirruping and whistling. Tom saw butterflies quivering and winking. Tom called the conies out till the sun was sinking. Old Tom Bombadil hurried home to supper, unlocked his house again, opened up the shutter, let in the setting sun in the kitchen shining, watching stars peering out and the moon climbing. Dark came under hill. Tom, he lit a candle. Upstairs creaking went, turned the door handle. "Ooh, Tom Bombadil, I am waiting for you just here behind the door. I came up before you. You forgotten Barrow White dwelling in the old mound up there atop the hill with the ring of stones round. He's got loose tonight under the earth he'll take you. Poor Tom Bombadil, pale and cold he'll make you. Go out, shut the door and don't slam it after. Take away gleaming eyes, take your hollow laughter. Go back to grassy mound on your stony pillow. Lay down your bony head like old man Willow, like young Goldberry and badger folk in Burrow. Go back to buried gold and forgotten sorrow. Out fled Barrow White, through the window flying, through yard, over wall, up the hill a-crying, past white drowsing sheep, over leaning stone rings, back under lonely mound, rattling his bone rings. So there we go. There are a few extracts from the original poem that was published first in the Oxford Magazine on the 15th of February 1934. And you can see that there was originally a peacock feather that lived in Tom Bombadil's hat. We see that Tom originally got caught by Old Man Willow, which paved the way for the eventual future capture of dear Pippin and Merry. And we have the Barrow White encounter inside Tom's house itself. But I'm going to leave that there. There'll be more about that particular aspect in the next episode. So, there we go. One more episode in the can. It's round about now that I must thank my wonderful friends, co-hosts James and May, and looking forward to getting back behind the mic with both of you guys soon. Also mention our Facebook group, so the Green Door Podcast. Do come along, knock on the door and say hello. It's lovely in there. Really, really good set of people, very friendly. So do come along and get involved. We've also got Twitter as well, so come find us there. And as I've touched on, the next episode will be continuing the first phase, but exploring the chapter entitled Tom Bombadil. So there we go. Stay safe. Look after each other. This is Second Breakfast. Done.